Good afternoon, and may it please the court. My name is Shan Jeffrey, attorney registration number 28689, and I represent Joe Martinez in this appeal. As I proceed with my argument, please feel free to interrupt me and ask questions at any time. Your Honors, this appeal involves two very divergent theories of the prosecution, or of the case. At trial, the defense argued self-defense, and the prosecution argued ambush. What bothers me so much about this case is that the jury reached its verdict in a vacuum. By that, I mean that the jury convicted Joe Martinez without knowledge of two critical facts. One, the history of domestic violence perpetrated by the deceased on his family. And two, prior entering the property where the deceased was shot, he threatened to come over and slice up the family. Had the jury known these facts, it would have known the true historical context for judging the initial confrontation on the porch. Without this context, the jury could not properly evaluate the affirmative defense of self-defense, including the initial aggressor determination. And without the jury instruction explaining that it could consider the deceased's character for violence when evaluating the initial aggressor question, the jury did not know how to evaluate the minimal evidence of the deceased's violent character that it was allowed to know.
Didn't the judge in a pretrial ruling indicate that if circumstances presented themselves during the trial and the evidence permitted it, he would allow that testimony, but it was never offered during the trial?
Well, I believe what the trial judge said was that she was not convinced at this stage of pretrial that that was going to be relevant, and she wasn't going to give a ruling of admissibility right then, but she would see how the evidence came out. To me, that suggests there is a factual predicate that the prosecution's evidence must establish before she's willing to allow that type of defense evidence.
It could also mean defense evidence, could it not?
Well, but if that's the defense case, how are we supposed to put it on? I mean, she was talking about in terms of we'll see what evidence comes out, and it, from the context, it looks like she was talking about the prosecution's case.
And testified at the pretrial about the statement, "I'm going to slice you up." Who testified about the pretrial? It was the woman who lived with the defendant, right? The wife of the victim.
Yes, actually, that was an excited utterance. So that was in the paperwork.
Did she testify about that at the pretrial, or was it just...
Frankly, I can't remember if that was brought up during the Make My Day hearing or not.
So how at trial did they offer to, did the defendant offer to introduce or try to bring in that evidence of the statement that the woman had made?
As an excited utterance that was documented in the police report, Your Honor.
But witness was asked the question about the statement that would have allowed the answer to be given. Where did it happen in the trial, in other words, that they raised this, made this effort to get the evidence in? That's what I'm trying to get at.
Oh, it was a pretrial determination where the defense wanted to bring it in, and a proffer was made on the excited utterance, but the court ruled that inconsistent statements that the trial judge felt would impeach that excited utterance that were made later in time would also be allowed through the theory of opening the door. And when that happened, the defense withdrew its proffer for that excited utterance because, I don't know why, but it was based on that incorrect ruling of law.
But I'm not aware of what these statements were that the prosecution might have used to impeach the excited utterance.
Actually, I believe we are. I documented that in a reply brief. I can get it if you'd like.
No, you don't. No.
Okay.
Just tell me what they are.
But it was something to the extent of that she was making inconsistent statements about how much she felt threatened by the defendant, even though the statement was made, that she didn't find the defendant credible. But that did not comment on whether the other occupants of the dwelling found him credible or not.
Well, she didn't testify because she had charges pending against her at the time arising out of this.
Exactly. The DA had also filed a first-degree murder charge against her, and that was quickly disposed of after this trial. She was allowed to enter a plea agreement after this trial. So to me, the timing of that is also suspicious, because to me, it seems like the DA was trying to suppress her testimony at trial by leaving these pending charges out there until right after the conviction entered in this case, at which time she was allowed a very favorable plea agreement. If this were to be tried again, that would no longer be a problem, and her testimony could come out, because based on the rule prohibiting double jeopardy, she could not be tried twice. She's already entered her plea. If this were to come to trial again, there would be nothing prohibiting her from testifying, and the truth would finally reach the jury about what really happened that night.
You didn't raise that as a separate issue. You're only raising the limitation on the admissibility of the excited utterance. Is that correct?
Well, I incorporated it into my issues as prejudice, really. But it's not a separate issue on appeal, because I didn't feel like I had the record to really tell what happened behind the scenes. There was only a little bit of mention on that in the record, but it wasn't substantiated enough that I felt I could raise that on direct appeal.
Point us to a place in the record where a question was asked of a witness, and I guess it's not the woman because she took the Fifth Amendment.
Right.
Where a question was asked of a witness that would have elicited an answer that reflected on the victim's character for violence. Where in the record was such a question ever asked during the trial of a witness, if at all?
Well, Your Honor, what did come out during trial was the conversation between the deceased and his son. And that reflected that the deceased had initially wanted to bring over tactical knives and a gun to the initial confrontation where he entered the yard and tried to get into the house. So we know that much at least. We also know that he was extremely angry after the series of 18 phone calls that he placed to his ex-wife or wife, whatever their status was.
Where did that testimony come from? Also the son?
The son testified to that, yes, Your Honor. And so there was some evidence of his violence that evening, at least at the time that they planned to go over. Now, there is also evidence that the son talked him out of taking all that weaponry over with him, but...
Where is the attempt to bring in other evidence and the judge saying you can't bring that evidence in, I think is the question.
Well, that was... The violent character of the deceased was fully litigated in the Make My Day hearing.
How about a trial? What would have alerted this second judge that you wanted to produce evidence of violent character or reputation, and the judge said, no, you can't do that?
The two pretrial rulings is what I'm talking about.
But she didn't say, no, you can't do that.
She was noncommittal, but she said that I would need to have some kind of evidentiary threshold before I would even allow you to offer that evidence in the first place. And so defense counsel took that as a qualified no, but the judge never told her that, okay, the evidentiary threshold has been made, now we can admit this defense evidence. And even that was even acknowledged in the motion for new trial after trial, where the defense counsel at trial represented in her motion that, yes, I tried to get this in, it was denied, and the judge's response to that in the written ruling acknowledged that fact as well. So however you read the record now, when you look at the motion for new trial and the judge's answer to that in the written ruling, it's quite obvious that they both believed that evidence was not coming in, and there was a ruling saying that.
I read it as the glass was half full. You read it as the glass was half empty. I think the court was leaving the door open for defense counsel to do something at trial, and defense counsel never did so. I don't know what he would have done. I don't know what his investigation might have shown, but he didn't put anything as a predicate.
Well, we do know what the investigation would have shown, because we have the Make My Day hearing that fully litigated all that prior to trial. So we know what evidence would have been offered. Perhaps there was a misunderstanding between counsel and the judge about her ruling, because she sort of said.
You also have to change judges. You also have to change judges.
That's right. Yeah, the trial judge was Judge Mattoon, and the previous Make My Day hearing judge was Judge Cole. But either way, it's certainly acknowledged that with respect to the initial aggressor instruction, we were entitled to get that instruction into the packet under Jones, and the court denied that. And that is preserved, and that's acknowledged to be preserved.
You did ask for that instruction at trial? You asked for the Make My Day instruction?
No. I'm talking about the instructions saying that evidence of the deceased's violent character may be used in the initial aggressor determination. That's what I'm talking about.
Where's the evidence in the record that the defendant knew of this violent tendency, violent reputation?
Well, it actually comes in under two evidentiary theories, Your Honor. The first one is if the defendant knows of violent acts, then it's direct evidence of what the defendant is expecting to happen. The second way it comes in is as circumstantial evidence of whether the deceased was more likely to be the initial aggressor or not, irrespective of whether the defendant knew about those violent acts, and that's explained in Jones. So whether or not he knew, but he did have some knowledge, because that came out in the Make My Day hearing as well, where Saezfa testified that he knew a little bit about the violent nature of the relationship between them, knew he wasn't a nice guy, knew he wasn't to be messed with. And then, of course, when he threatened to solicit the family, that would have been the final acknowledgement.
Well, doesn't shooting him five times and dragging him into the middle of the street and shooting him a sixth time sort of indicate he might not be the initial aggressor?
Well, we don't know, Your Honor, because we don't even know. First of all, we don't know who shot him in the yard. We certainly know that it was Tapia that shot him in the street. But second of all, we don't know what happened because nobody could testify to what happened on the porch. And if he had threatened to come over and slice up the family, and then he's coming to try to get in the house.
Okay, someone could have testified to that threat. The detective could have testified to that threat. In fact, it was determined that it would be proper for the detective to testify to that threat. But someone made a decision not to elicit that evidence. Isn't that correct?
But only based on the court's incorrect ruling that it would open the door to inadmissible testimony. I'd like to save the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Well, can I ask one question with no time? With no time allowed, why wouldn't it have been, as the people had suggested in a brief, proper to say, I'm admitting this evidence, go ahead, try to get your evidence in, and I'll take that up on appeal later?
Well,
why wouldn't that have been the proper procedure to preserve this issue?
So risk the fact that inadmissible evidence would
have been admissible?
Well, she basically said that it would have, didn't she, the trial judge?
No. You're claiming you were precluded from admitting the excited utterance by this chilling effect or this threat to keep out the other, admit other evidence.
Right.
Why wouldn't, to preserve the evidence, you bring in your evidence, the prosecution brings whatever evidence it thinks it can get in, and then if things go wrong, appeal that incorrect ruling on appeal then, as opposed to perhaps being speculative as to what the prosecution would have introduced?
Well, if we put on our evidence without knowledge of whether that damaging other evidence is going to, you know, make it in, that could be the difference between a guilty and not guilty verdict. We could be ineffective for bringing it in without knowing what the consequences would be for that evidence. So I think in order to be effective, we have to know if that's going to open the door to damaging evidence. Thank you.
Save your time. You have 3 minutes, 10 seconds.
18.
For some reason, they took off 2 seconds.
Must have taken off 8 then.
Yes, it is. May it please the court, my name is Elizabeth Rohrbaugh, and I represent the people of the state of Colorado. It's my position with regard to the first issue that the defense really doesn't have a claim that the defense was precluded from presenting evidence of the victim's character because the defense never unsuccessfully offered any such evidence at trial. What we have in terms of rulings by the trial court are the April 3rd ruling and the April 8th ruling. And in both of those rulings, the trial court said that the defense could not mention such evidence of the victim's character in either voir dire or an opening statement. But the court said some of that may come out in this trial and you'll have to wait and see.
At that point in time, they know that the
describe her, the former girlfriend of
Saifa?
Yeah, I can't pronounce her name either. Saifa?
I bet.
Did they know that she was going to take the Fifth Amendment at that time? Or was the judge contemplating that maybe she would and maybe she wouldn't, and we'll see what comes out of trial?
You know, I don't recall any discussion of that at the time. She was still charged. She pled guilty to accessory after this trial. And there's some discussion during trial about her availability. But I don't know.
Did they actually call her, and did she actually take the stand and say, I'm taking the Fifth? I mean, outside the presence of the jury? She was never actually called.
She was never actually called.
By either side?
By either side. Now, when we look at these pretrial rulings, one of the things that I think is interesting is...
Counsel, before we go on, it would have been improper for the prosecution to call her knowing that she was taking a Fifth Amendment privilege, would it not?
That's correct. It's improper.
As well as for the defense counsel knowing she was taking a Fifth Amendment privilege.
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
If you look at the rulings, defense counsel indicates... First of all, that he doesn't intend to bring in prior acts of domestic violence. He also says that he'll approach the bench if he wants to admit something of the sort. So both of these statements by defense counsel tend to indicate that this was an open issue, which was then subsequently never pursued by the defense. In looking at the evidence that came out at this Make My Day hearing, what was very clear was that the defendant had no knowledge of the prior acts of domestic violence. I mean, that's what Saifa testified to. She said, yeah, I didn't discuss this with him. I just told him the defendant that my ex-husband wasn't a nice guy. So it was in a footnote in my statement of the case that I noted that the standard under Jones is that a defendant has to know of the victim's prior act of violence in order for it to be admissible to show that he made a reasonable choice under self-defense. So I think all along it was clear, unless somehow the defendant was going to testify that he, in fact, had knowledge, that Saifa's testimony had been that she did not share with him the incidences of domestic violence.
No indication that she shared with him the message that he was going to come over and slice up everybody.
No, Your Honor. There was no indication that was shared. I mean, when we look at evidence that was at the pretrial Make My Day hearing, there was some evidence that the defendant had actually had a heated telephone conversation with the victim, which had then caused the victim to come over to the house. I think also Saifa made statements to the police that she had seen both defendants drag the body through the yard. She'd said to them, get that out of my yard, and they had done so at her request. So I think there were many reasons why the defense perhaps wouldn't have wanted Saifa to testify, because I think some of her testimony would not have been favorable to the defendant, but that's just an aside. In talking about the excited utterance issue, it's my position that this is not ripe for review because, in fact, no such evidence was admitted. What we have is a...
Let me ask you, counsel. You cited some authorities in your brief, and the parentheticals and the quotes you had seem to be, to me to be applicable. Don't we have a line of cases in Colorado talking about, sometimes chilling effect rulings are reviewable? Do you recall any of those, or what the context they were made in?
The only ruling, the one that comes off the top of my head, and of course we haven't briefed this, would be questions with regard to the defendant's right to testify and whether that was impermissibly chilled. And that would be a right, of course, that's personal to the defendant. So I think that might be a slightly different context than something that's a tactical choice made by defense counsel with regard to the admission of evidence. So it's my position that this just is not reviewable. It's not ripe because, in fact, No evidence was admitted. I don't think that the defendant can claim that the trial court precluded him from admitting this threat statement because the court ruled the threat statement would be admissible. But I don't think he can claim that he was prejudiced by the court's statement that other inconsistent statements might come in, because that would be speculative. No such statements came in because defense counsel made a strategic choice to not let either in. And I think the defense would have to walk through the door in order to have an appealable issue.
Is the detective called to testify?
Yes, the detective testified. And I didn't want to talk about that.
Let me just ask a question. So when the detective was called to testify, the defendant was about to ask him about this threat to slice up the family and basically backed away when the judge said, if you do that, all the other evidence is coming in. That's basically what happened?
Your Honor, there were two rulings. The first ruling was on April 10th when the detective testified.
And
No, this was during trial. The detective testified on April 10th, and the defense set up the question by saying, so you came to the scene and said that it was on the court and was she excited? At that point, the prosecution objected. And what the court said at the time was there was some issue about Crawford, which was relatively newer at the time. And so the court postponed discussion until several days later. And so we actually then have the ruling, I believe it was on the 18th, when the parties came back to the issue and discussed the matter.
Also with the detective on the stand?
No, the detective had left the stand. What the defense had said was, we can recall him.
Okay.
So the defense had agreed that he could be recalled if the court ruled that he could testify.
And I assume one of the reasons the defense wanted the statement to come out was that's how they would have shown the hostile nature of the victim, that they were arguing on their first point to us today, that he had a hostile nature and it would have come out through this threat to the Mrs. I can't remember pronounce her name, Saestva.
I believe it's Saestva, yes.
All right. So they backed off and they didn't ask the question.
That's correct.
When the judge said this other stuff would come in.
Correct.
When the judge said the other stuff would come in, did she ever rule that it was on the base of completeness or simply on the grounds that it was proper impeachment?
Just on the grounds that it was proper impeachment, citing CRE 806 and saying inconsistent statements could come in. The defense was quite concerned that they had to be directly inconsistent with her testimony, with her excited utterance, and the court agreed that was so. So there was that agreement from the court that only things that were directly inconsistent. I don't recall a proffer of what exactly those statements would be. I picked two statements out of the Make My Day hearing as possible statements that might be admissible, which would be both that the victim actually came over after a heated phone call with the defendant, and also that the Saestva said that the victim had made threats all the time and that she didn't take them all that seriously because he'd never actually acted on them. So I picked those two statements out in my brief and incited.
She said the defendant talked to the victim before he came over? Isn't that the conversation in which the threat was made?
She said that at the Make My Day hearing, yes.
So this was made to the defendant, not to her?
Your Honor, I don't know, because what we have is admitted at trial that there were 18 different statements, 18 different communications between the victim and Saestva's cell phone. So we know that there were these telephone conversations. We know that the son testified that apparently the victim was upset based on these telephone conversations. I don't actually know. I believe the threat was made to Saestva because she was the one who was going to repeat the threat. I don't know that it was actually made to the defendant. As I said, there was some testimony that the victim came over to the house based on a heated conversation with the defendant, but I don't know that this threat was a part of that particular conversation. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
The other point that I would just like to make briefly
is that this isn't really a case for the strong self-defense argument because of the execution-style shooting of the victim at the end. While it's true that he was initially shot 5 times by the porch, we don't know what the circumstances were of those 5 shots, or whether it was the defendant or the co-defendant who fired them. We do know that he was very seriously injured from those 5 shots, including one of his legs was broken, an arm was rendered useless, and then his lifeless body was dragged through the yard. There was a difference of opinion between the expert for the prosecution, which was that 2 men would have dragged him through the yard, and the defense expert, which was that only 1 man could have dragged him through the yard.
Say his lifeless body was dragged through the yard?
I'm sorry. Lifeless would be incorrect on my part.
I was just going to...
Lifeless, perhaps, in that he might have been unconscious, and he certainly would not have been moving. I'm certainly saying that he was alive at the time, and I apologize if that's a poor adjective. It was also the people's position that it was a 6-shooter gun and that 6 shots had been fired up at the porch, 5 into the victim's body and 1 was a bullet strike into the house. So the gun also had to be reloaded by the time the body was dragged to the street and the co-defendant took the final shot. So at this point where we have this, and I believe helpless is the adjective I wanted, Judge Daly, and not lifeless. We have the helpless victim who's shot in the head, which is the murder. So I think it's really not a good self-defense case when push comes to shove. There's some references in the record to the fact that in instructing in the co-defendant's case, the trial court gave an instruction about the nature of self-defense, but did not give an instruction that in fact it was an affirmative defense, because it doesn't really seem like it was a viable affirmative defense under the circumstances.
No, I have a question.
Good, because I have 2 minutes left.
You do, and I thought you were about to sit down. Let's go to the erroneous instruction on after deliberation. And my question has to do with your assertion in your brief that the claim was not adequately or properly preserved. Did not the defense counsel say it's not appropriate to give an instruction additional to the statutory definition?
Yes, she said essentially it was superfluous to the statutory definition, but she appeared to agree with the prosecution that it was a correct statement of law. And so no one brought to the trial court's attention the Key case, which would indicate that it's not a correct statement of the law.
But when she, at least one time, maybe twice, said, I don't think it's appropriate to give this, although didn't have a specific argument about it would be error to give this, Is this not sum and substance? Are we splitting too many, hairs on the edge of the needle here to say, no, this wasn't properly preserved?
I don't think we're splitting too many hairs because, in fact, the argument essentially raised by defense counsel is that this is merely superfluous, not that it was an inappropriate statement of law. And I think that would have made a huge difference in the trial court's reaction. And that's what's important about objections, is they have to be specific enough for a trial court to either prevent or mitigate error. So telling the court this is an erroneous statement of law would have certainly helped the court prevent error in this case. It's clear by the time we look at the motion for new trial ruling that the court is by then aware of the Key case. But the court was never made aware of it, and that's why I think that this is not preserved.
You want to wait for it to tick down? Or?
I'm very careful. I think I will say that I'll thank this court for its time and attention. I ask you to affirm the defendant's conviction.
Thank you, counsel.
On the time interval instruction, the defendant stated that the time interval instruction was, quote, not proper. The court was on notice of the objection and should have double-checked at that point to make sure that it was legally correct. Sayas's later made custodial statements were not prior inconsistent statements within the meaning of the hearsay exception. They were made later in time, and they were subject to the opportunity for fabrication. Even if they were inconsistent with the excited utterance, they in no way impeached the credibility of the excited utterance, which was inherently reliable. Despite the
Why not put in the statement, the excited utterance, if that's true? Why not offer it?
They certainly tried. The court would not allow it and said that it would open the door to this other inadmissible and damaging testimony, evidence. So in order to...
The court would allow it subject to the other statements.
Right, subject to. But at that point, that's a different analysis.
If the statements are of no consequence, why not put in the excited utterance?
Well, that would obviously be our argument, you know, in rebuttal, right, to those statements coming in. But if it's so damaging that it precludes us from putting the excited utterance on in the first place and still remaining effective assistance of counsel, then we can't put on the statement. And I wanted to take just a second, I only have a minute and a half left, but to say that, you know, there's a clear distinction here between the initial confrontation, where we don't really know exactly what happened, who was the initial aggressor, and the later shot to the head. The reason that the self-defense theory is so important to this case is because the jury needed to know that it wasn't strictly an ambush, as the prosecution was arguing. The jury needed to know that the people in that house were on the defensive for a good reason. And through that context, when you analyze the paucity of evidence on complicity for the final shot to the head, it becomes very clear that that was not deliberated in any way by my client, who was not the shooter. If you think of this as an ambush, it puts everything in a different light. It puts, you know, it makes it much more easy to believe that this could have all been deliberated from the get-go. But that's not the case here. The jury needed to know the correct factual context for the initial confrontation to know how attenuated that was from Tapia's final action, which looks on the record to be very hasty and impulsive.
What was Tapia's interest in all this?
What was his interest?
I mean, he
probably didn't want to get sliced up with the knife like the defendant had threatened. Because he was in the house. He was in the dwelling like everybody else. And the threat was made against every occupant of the dwelling of the house.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank both counsel for their argument. The case will be deemed submitted. A written opinion will issue in due course. Thank you. Second case.